These are all situational realities. California, you see that EKG, it still shows this momentum moving in the right direction. I have absolutely no trepidation around California's fate and future. I think we're better positioned than any other jurisdiction in the world.
Governor Gavin Newsom speaking at a news conference yesterday about the state's budget, trying to put a positive spin on the news that the state is facing a possible $22 billion budget deficit this year. Newsom is proposing big cuts to the state's climate and transportation budget, all while the state reels from a series of devastating storms made worse by climate change. Around 50,000 people across the state were under evacuation orders yesterday as water flooded their neighborhoods. Even in less affected areas, there's water damage to homes, to roads, to highways, sewage, and electrical systems, and on and on. Climate experts predict all of this damage could cost the state more than $1 billion. And there are more storms on the way. Joining me to discuss the fate of California's climate spending is Jeremy White. He writes the California Playbook for Politico. Welcome back to Press Play.
Always a pleasure.
Always great to have you. Okay, new year, new state budget. And now we have a looming possible $22 billion deficit. How did that happen?
In short, capital gains and stock market factors like that, that heavily influenced California's budget, given how our progressive taxation structure really relies on the richest Californians thriving. And just as we have seen across the economy with a plunging stock market and some tumult in the tech industry, so we have seen with California that personal income in particular was way down. And that has results for the amount of revenue that the state has to work with.
So it is quite a whiplash from just last year when the state had a $100 billion surplus. So was none of that squirreled away for a rainy day?
Great question. Some of that was squirreled away for a rainy day. In fact, California's Rainy Day Fund, which the voters created via ballot initiative in 2014, has about $22 million in it. And so, excuse me, billion with a B. And so there is certainly money stashed for a rainy day. The question is California going to use it? Governor Newsom yesterday said he was not yet ready to call for opening up that rainy day fund. It requires essentially the governor to declare a fiscal emergency. He wants to wait until we get those updated revenue numbers in May, which is when the updated budget blueprint really tends to start things in earnest. And I think that's going to be a point of contention. I certainly noticed that the leader of Assembly Democrats, Speaker Anthony Rendon, said in his statement that he really thinks we should be considering in June whether we do need to open that rainy day fund to ensure California keeps spending money on things like schools and healthcare. So I suspect that is going to be a point of debate between the governor and lawmakers.
Right. Okay. And so in the meantime, Newsom is proposing slashing billions of dollars from climate and transportation programs. The timing doesn't look good here.
That is certainly one of the big reductions in this budget. In order to make up for that shortfall, there is a lot of delaying spending. There is a lot of what are called trigger cuts, which is essentially money that may end up in there if things look better in May and may not. And climate and transportation spending are definitely being heavily cut. The governor wants to spend, rather than what had been about $54 billion in the next few years, down to $48 billion. Now, still a lot of money, but $6 billion fewer dollars, that's a major impact.
So what would that specifically affect?
There are a lot of different areas that could see less money. The governor wants to spend less money on intercity rail. He is proposing to cut money from areas like electric vehicles. That one is particularly frustrating for some environmentalists because, as you may remember, Governor Newsom very vehemently opposed Prop 30 this last election, which would have raised taxes on those top earners in order to pay for electric vehicles and infrastructure. The argument from supporters was, look, when the budget is flush as it is now, yes, we're spending money on this, but we need a locked-in revenue source for when things take a turn. Well, as it turns out, things have taken a turn, and electric vehicles are going to see less money as a result. Mm-hmm. So definitely saw some disappointment from some climate advocates yesterday.
Right. So that would maybe lessen or get rid of the incentives for people to buy EVs. But at the same time, the governor wants gas-powered vehicles phased out completely by 2035. Would he change that goal?
I think that goal is locked in. And the governor made the point yesterday that he believes that the markets and, more importantly, car companies are moving in that direction. And it is true that car companies that plan out their future models years in advance recognize that this is on the books in California. And more broadly, the auto industry in America and globally is moving in that direction. So the governor is not wrong in that some of that movement is already underway. But if you ask environmental advocates, they'll tell you in order to get to that, all new car sales by 2035 have to be EVs or hybrids. Advocates say we need a lot more money to be spent. And some of that is to purchase electric vehicles. A lot of that is charging infrastructure, particularly in things like multifamily buildings. So it's a pretty ambitious goal that Gavin Newsom put into law. And there is clearly going to be a fair amount that has to happen between now and 2035 to mm-hmm. achieve that.
Okay. Meanwhile, as I mentioned in the intro, we're looking at least $1 billion or so in costs related to all of these storms. How does the governor say the state is going to pay for that? Or is he hoping for federal funding?
And the governor had already, he already said even before the budget that he was going to ask the legislature for more money to address storms and flooding. He'd been in touch with the White House. So that is something that there is certainly some money in the budget for. I would also just note that, again, this is something that is very much sort of an opening proposal. And so we will see what happens in May, in which we are a little further out from these storms and also have a chance to assess where things stand with the drought. Mm-hmm. I don't think any meteorologists think that as much rain as we've gotten, it means the drought is over, but it has certainly made a substantial dent.
All right. Jeremy White, he writes the California Playbook for Politico. Jeremy, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Planes are back in the air again after the FAA grounded all domestic flights for around 90 minutes this morning. The agency said a system that sends safety information to pilots failed, though it's still unclear what caused that. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says there is no evidence of a cyber attack. Around 7,000 flights were delayed, making it yet another difficult day for travelers. Certainly not a good look after tens of thousands of passengers were stranded over the holidays, first because of weather, then a major meltdown on Southwest Airlines. Brian Summers is the editor of the Airline Observer. That's a newsletter that covers the airline business. Welcome back to Press Play, Brian.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Good to have you. All right. So let's first look at this FAA disruption. And when you have such a huge disruption, just grounding all domestic flights, how long before everything gets back on schedule?
The good news is that it's a Wednesday, and it's a Wednesday in January. I know this doesn't make sense for people who are at the airports right now, but it's not a huge travel day. So I actually think this is only going to be about a one-day story. My guess is that by Thursday, by the long weekend, things will be relatively back to normal. But you can't take solace in that if you're flying today. It's going to be a mess all day at the airports.
Right. Okay. So I've never heard of this system before. It has an antiquated name, I believe. But how susceptible are these systems to failure?
Well, Madeline, I'll diverge here for a second. It used to have a more antiquated name. It used to be Notice to Airmen. And about 2 years ago, they changed it to make it more inclusive to Notice to Air Missions. Uh-huh. And these are communications that pilots get that tell them what's going on at the airports that they're going to be landing at. So is there a runway that isn't in operation? Is there a taxiway that they can't use? So they're used to getting these things. They can be important. A lot of them, pilots say, are not that important. But every now and then you get one and you say, oh, I didn't know that at the airport that I'm landing at. And so pilots need it.
Okay. So normally the FAA does a pretty seamless job, or at least we can't see from our vantage point on the ground or in the planes themselves. These things don't happen very often. At least I've never heard of this happening. So should we feel pretty confident in the computer systems the FAA has?
Well, we should feel confident in the safety mechanisms that the FAA has. But the dirty secret in the airline industry is that the federal government is almost as bad at sort of this tech stuff as the airlines themselves. In fact, last summer, Madeline, you'll remember that the FAA and Secretary Buttigieg kind of blasted airlines for not getting the job done for their passengers, for not investing in infrastructure. And airline people were telling me, and they were telling the public too, hey, FAA, you know, people in glass houses can't throw stones. The airline people say that the FAA has been underfunded for years. They say that the FAA has not invested enough in both technology and people. So you have certain situations where if one or two people call out sick at an FAA building, then flights are going to be delayed or canceled that day. There's actually been a lot of snickering recently between the FAA and airlines about whose fault which delays are.
That brings us to Southwest and this insane meltdown. 16,000 or more flights were canceled, and the federal government is taking a pretty hard line with Southwest. What is the airline trying to do now to make it up to passengers?
Yeah, you're right, Madeline. This one was wild. I know passengers think that all airlines are the same and all outages are the same. But the fact is, you know, other carriers did not have the same problems as Southwest recovering from these storms and cold weather. This was a Southwest only thing. And really, on a legal basis, Southwest is only required to give refunds to passengers who are wronged during this time. But this has been a major hit to the airline's brand because they don't want to lose their customers. They've come out and they've said, we're going to try to make everything right. So if you incurred extra costs during this meltdown, if you had to stay extra nights in hotel or extend your rental car or even book a very expensive ticket on another airline, Southwest has said it will make you whole. This is going to take a really long time for Southwest to get people all the money that they're owed. I already see on social media folks complaining. It's going to take some time, but this is a big deal that mm-hmm. Southwest is paying all this money back.
Yeah. So it says it could cost them around $825 million or more. Do they have the money for this?
They're going to find it some way or another. I mean, airlines are not making the big profits that they were making before the pandemic, but people are buying plane tickets. The airline has cash flow. They can go take out debt. Southwest understands that it needs to do this. They've had 50 years of positive press, and they don't want to go down because of the meltdown. They don't want to be known as the airline that disappointed people. They want to be known as the airline that disappointed people and then made things right.
So quickly, what was it exactly that they did wrong? I understand it had something to do with the fact that they didn't have modern ways to schedule their employees.
Yeah, you know, it was explained to me this way, and it was kind of crazy for me to hear it. They lost track of their crews. You know, think about how many pilots and flight attendants an airline has, right? Thousands. You know where the airplanes are because that's pretty easy, but you don't have a GPS tracker on your pilots or flight attendants. So you cancel all these flights. You know, nobody's doing anything wrong. They kind of disappear. Nobody knows what's going on. Nobody knows who's in charge. And so Southwest didn't have the technological mechanisms or any other mechanisms to find the pilots and flight attendants and then reassign them to other flights. You know, ideally when the system goes down, when you have to cancel or delay flights, you say, okay, these pilots and these flight attendants are now reassigned to a new trip. You're not going to go to Burbank anymore. You're going to go to San Francisco. That sort of crew scheduling system, it just completely melted down. And as it was explained to me, this was because Southwest had not invested the time or the money into the kind of the back end software that would allow them to track and reassign these people.
It's just mind boggling. So we are kind of at their mercy, whether they decide to do that or not, because people need to fly. You can't really hop on a train these days, even to go up to San Francisco. It's, you know, it's unthinkable. So we're going to get back on a Southwest airplane, right?
I think most of us are going to get back on a Southwest airplane. We'll get back on a Southwest airplane because it's the cheapest option. We'll get back on a Southwest airplane because we live near Ontario Airport or Long Beach Airport or Burbank, and Southwest is the clear market leader at those places, and we don't want to go through a big airlines hub. We'll get back on Southwest because we're traveling with a family of four and we're checking six bags, and you know, most of those are going to be free. Southwest has a clear differentiator. They're a little bit different than the big three airlines. They're different than the ultra low cost carriers. They have a lot of people that like them very much. And I do think that over time, most of those passengers are going to return to Southwest. Maybe not all of them, though. It was pretty bad.
Yeah. All right, Brian, thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Madeline.
That's Brian Summers, editor of the Airline Observer, and that's a newsletter that covers the airline business. Once considered the future of the Republican Party and Paul Ryan's protege, New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik is now Paul Ryan's biggest disappointment. She has gone full MAGA. Coming up, we'll find out why the Harvard-educated former moderate shapeshifted, losing her friends along the way. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Last year, President Biden started referring to extreme far-right Republicans as ultra-MAGA. It was not a compliment. A few days later, a reporter shouted a question about it to the third-ranking House Republican, New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, being called ultra-MAGA. I am ultra-MAGA. I'm proud of it.
Ultra-MAGA and proud of it, she says there. A surprising turn for someone who won her seat campaigning as a moderate millennial, a Paul Ryan protege with establishment cred. But now she has gone full Trump with nods to QAnon and racist conspiracy theories, embracing his big lie about election fraud. It's helped rocket her to the GOP leadership. She replaced Wyoming's Liz Cheney. But it also alienated her friends and mentors along the way. And that's according to my next guest, New York Times political and investigative reporter Nicholas Confessori. He has written a big profile that is headlined The Invention of Elise Stefanik. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks. Okay, well, first, before we get into her bio, let's just talk about the latest news and, of course, the speaker battle. She was firmly in the now speaker, Kevin McCarthy, camp. She gave one of the nominating speeches. So I'm wondering, I mean, we're talking about shapeshifting. Is she the female McCarthy?
You know, in some ways, there's a lot in common. You know, Kevin McCarthy has also transitioned from being a somewhat moderate Republican in California and a friend of Silicon Valley to a, you know, a MAGA Trump person who hates big tech. And, you know, I think you've seen a lot of this. I focused on Elise Stefanik, I think, because her shapeshift here, which is not an uncommon move in the party over the last few years, It's the most obvious example, the most brazen example I think we have of some lawmakers in the GOP who didn't just, you know, try to get through the Trump years with their heads down, but decided, I'm going to join what he's doing. I'm going to give up my old ideals and principles because I want to be where the action is in my party. And that's what happened to Elise Stefanik.
Okay, well, let's get a little background on her. In 2014, she is at age 30, the youngest woman ever to be elected to Congress. And so let's talk about how she got there. How did she get there? She went to Harvard. She grew up in the Albany area, and she worked at the Bush White House and has kind of, you know, successes and failures along the way. And then she catches the eye of Paul Ryan. Why?
Well, I think Paul Ryan, for whom she worked on the 2012 campaign as a debate prep handler, saw her as a young version of himself, as somebody who was in his mind, principled and pragmatic and in it for the right reasons, thoughtful and a policy wonk. And those are all the qualities that he cares about. And so he brought her along. He introduced her to donors. He raised money for her first campaign. And it wasn't necessarily an easy campaign because up in the North Country in her district, I think she was not an obvious candidate to the kind of crusty older male political establishment up there. Mm-hmm. But she was closely embraced by the Bush establishment in Washington, which brought her along, promoted her, got her jobs, got her fundraising help. So when she won the primary for the Republican Party in 2014 in that district, it was kind of all up from there. And when she was elected, she quoted from Lean In. She gave a couple of interviews to talk about kind of why she was in it. And she, kind of branded herself as an aspirational person, hopeful, positive, pragmatic, and bipartisan. And that was how she started.
Well, just to underscore that, I want to play a clip from an ad from her first campaign of sort of her from the before times.
Our next representative must spend every day working on improving our economy and bringing more jobs to the North Country, not playing the politics of personal destruction. Too many people are struggling and government is getting in the way. It's why I've pledged to you, not Washington.
Okay, so she's, goes on saying she's working for you, that she doesn't want to play the politics of personal destruction, as she said there, that she's doesn't want to play this whole game. And now that she doesn't sound like that at all. Describe what she sounds like now.
Well, you heard it in that clip you played at the start of the show. I am ultra MAGA, which is not something that anybody who knows her believes she really believes in. It's a posture. It's theater.
Yeah.
It's theater designed to keep open a line to Trump, who is the ultimate source of her juice in the House and her fundraising ability. It's a line designed to entice and gladden the grassroots fundraising base on the MAGA side of the equation. She basically tweets like Trump. She took all her intelligence, and she's a very smart woman, and all her knowledge of politics and audience and how to do messaging. And she applied that to aping Donald Trump, to becoming as much like him in terms of how she talked about Democrats, how she talked on Twitter, as she possibly could. So now she says things like, and Democrats are, quote, the party of socialists, criminals, communist truth ministers, and media stenographers. This is the kind of red meat that you throw out on Twitter to get engagement and ultimately to raise money. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone who knows her well believes that that's an expression of her true values or the way she really started out in politics. But it is what works to a certain extent in the magnified party that she's now a part of.
I mean, here's this Harvard-educated woman writing purposefully misspelled tweets to, that she never did before.
Yeah, the random capitalization.
Yeah.
It's a certain style. And she aped it. She took it from Trump, and she's trying to be kind of a mini-me of his on Twitter.
What was the moment of her conversion? When did she decide this is the road that I need to take?
One of the things we reported in our story that I was really fascinated to learn about from current and former friends and advisors is how unhappy she was in Congress after Trump was elected. She occupied a place that was fairly safe for her in political terms as kind of a center-right, cautious, Trump critic who would vote against him on the tax bill because it was bad for New Yorkers. Who opposed his effort to raid the military budget to build the border wall, and she wasn't, a John McCain maverick type, but she was pretty bipartisan, and she voted against the president on some big things. But what she found was that she just couldn't progress in that environment. Donald Trump, is not a policy wonk. He didn't care that she had the best argument for wherever the policy was. It's not how he made decisions. And what we saw in the House in the end of the Paul Ryan era was this impossibility of governing with the Freedom Caucus and the harder right members of that caucus really making it impossible for Paul Ryan to do a lot beyond the tax cut, which he did succeed on. Mm-hmm. And I think she just got to this point in her personal and professional life where her party was moving hard in a Trump direction. That's where the money and the influence was. And her close friends, her friends from Harvard, the people who were more Bushy or liberal, felt that she wasn't actually standing up hard enough against Trump. And so in her mind, in her world, I think she was getting it from both sides. She was getting attacked by Fox for being a squish on immigration, and she was getting attacked by her friends for not being a sterner attacker of Donald Trump. And there came this turning point, and I really think it happened between the end of the 2018 cycle, when Donald Trump accompanied her on a White House visit, an official visit, I should say, to Fort Drum to sign the defense authorization bill, where she saw that like the power of the presidency was really real. And at that event, she saw what could happen if she could harness her own agenda or a piece of it to the power of the presidency. And after that, she really begins to change and distance herself more from her old friends and her old persona. And then all of a sudden, and everyone's, probably remembers this, she became a star player in the first impeachment.
Right.
Defending
and,
him.
She hadn't been
taking on Adam Schiff.
She became absolutely his biggest defender. She joined his legal team. She played a big role in trying to undercut the Democratic investigation, to cast it all as partisan theater. And that happened pretty late. I mean, she was not a big player on the Republican side of the impeachment run-up. She didn't go to a ton of the meetings or the depositions. And then she just sort of popped out, and right. They kind of needed her. It was valuable to the rest of the party, even the Freedom Caucus types and the MAGA people, was that she wasn't identified as a MAGA person.
Right.
And she was also really good. Like, not every person in Congress can do the stuff that she does.
So we have just a minute left, and I guess I'm wondering if, like McCarthy, she's put herself in a terrible position because she isn't really viewed as a diehard true believer MAGA. You know, those people kind of look at her askance. And then her old friends don't want her around either. So what happens, especially now that Trump's star is fading? What happens to Elise Stefanik? And we just have a few seconds.
Look, I think that she has harnessed herself to Donald Trump, and sort of as he goes and succeeds or fails, so does she in the near term. Now, I will say she's still quite young by congressional standards,
yeah,
I should
she's
say.
38.
She has a long career. She probably has another act if she wants it. But right now, I think we're going to find out if the bet she has placed on tying herself so closely to this one singular figure is going to pay off.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It's a fascinating profile. I urge everyone to go read it. The Invention of Elise Stefanik in the New York Times Magazine. Nick Confessori, political and investigative reporter for the Times. Thanks a lot.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Coming up, how porn shaped the internet, including something so basic like the JPEG.
Someone brought a Playboy magazine into a computer science lab where they were developing image processing techniques. They were trying to figure out how to best do it over the internet.
How sex and the internet are intertwined, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We use the internet to do practically everything, to shop, to navigate places, even to go to school. But a lot of the ways we use the internet today, a lot of those ways were shaped by one thing, sex. Mark Zuckerberg famously created Facebook, after all, as a way to find attractive women at Harvard. And the porn industry ushered in broader tech innovations like JPEGs, which allow us to share pictures and images. And porn also drove the creation of online credit card payment systems and advertising revenue schemes. But just as sex changed the internet changed sex, shaping our desires and the ways we meet and connect with others. Samantha Cole is senior editor for Motherboard. Her new book is called How Sex Changed the Internet and the Internet Changed Sex. And as you might expect, we will be talking about sex. So please choose when and where you listen. Samantha Cole, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so good to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, well, take us way back to the early days before images, videos, before we were hooked to our devices and computers were everywhere. How did people use the internet to hook up?
Yeah, so this book kind of starts really back before the World Wide Web as we know it. So like you said, it was before we had images, before we had user interfaces that we could kind of click on things. So it was mostly text-based, or it was entirely text-based. And a lot of those systems were called bulletin board systems. So you would write a post, write a message about a topic that you're interested in, post it off into the ether, and then other people would reply. And it was kind of like a slow-mo Twitter almost. Yeah. You know, it was a lot more thoughtful than Twitter is today, I think. But yeah, it was entirely text-based. And it was based on phone modems. So it was mostly people in your local area because it was expensive to call long distance. But then you also had bulletin board systems that were devoted to sharing porn. So you could, you know, hook up to a bulletin board system that then you got information to go download you know, something like a scanned Playboy photo, or people scanned in Polaroids of themselves, things like that. So it was pretty rudimentary, but yeah, pretty, I think, a decent chunk of time where people were trading a lot of information.
Right. And you're saying that it was primarily legal and consenting and all that. It wasn't about sharing,
yeah,
I don't know, child porn images or
no,
sex trafficking victims or anything like that.
No, I mean, I think at the time it was people who had a technical interest in this kind of thing, because it took some doing. You know, you had to get a computer to your house, first of all, which was a lot harder than like going to the Apple store like we do it today. And then you had to figure out how to hook it up to these modems. And then you had to subscribe to the bulletin board, which usually involved calling the administrator and saying, hey, I am a normal person. I'm just interested in this. Here's my, you know, information. I'm going to mail you a check usually.
So like a moderator in today's terms, like someone you might see or would have seen on Twitter.
Yeah.
tell us about image sharing and JPEGs and all that, because you write that too began in the world of sex.
Yeah. So the classic story with that, the JPEG and, you know, how we developed then being able to display images on a screen basically was the early 70s. And someone brought a Playboy magazine into a computer science lab where they were developing image processing techniques. They were trying to figure out how to best do it over the internet. And someone brought the Playboy in and just had it around the office. It's the story is kind of, you know, like passed down over the years. The details get a little shaky.
Why would they just have it in the office? I'm just wondering.
Right. Someone just brought that in. Yeah, it was totally normal to bring your Playboy into the work.
You know, like lunchtime reading.
Yeah, totally. You know, I mean, you can tell who was probably in the office.
Right.
Mostly,
not a lot of
mostly
women.
Men. Yeah. But they were looking for an image that would be the standard that they would use for processing. You know, they were using like baskets of fruit and like flowers and things like that. And it was getting kind of, I guess, it was boring, and they also needed something more dynamic and they needed people. And someone saw the centerfold of a woman named Lena, and she was the Playboy centerfold, and they scanned in her face from like the shoulders up as the standard for that processing technique. And that became the standard for image processing for decades, like well into the 90s and 2000s, where people were just using that to base their image processing work on.
And did she know this?
She didn't. She kind of did the shoot and moved on. And then it wasn't until like years later that she got invited to a conference, and she actually went, and she was like, just kind of stunned that all of these like computer science nerds basically were like falling over themselves. Couldn't believe they could see this like celebrity in real life.
So she is the creator, if you will, of the JPEG.
Yeah. Yeah. She's like the godmother of the JPEG.
Wow. Yeah. So of course, once there's sex involved, there's a backlash, right? And so how did, as the computer business gets much bigger, how did these businesses deal with that fact that sex was the basis for so many innovations?
Yeah. I mean, it was a really fast kind of growth that the internet saw, obviously. We know this. I mean, it's still fast every day. But there was a lot of attempt to kind of regulate and legislate around what we can and can't do on the internet as far as sex and porn. And that happened all very, very early. And, you know, it kind of shaped the way that we use the internet today, just in the ways that people tried to figure out how to coexist with porn on the internet and the rest of everything else we wanted to do.
Well, it's interesting that in 1996, Congress passed the Communications Decency Act. Is that specifically targeting porn and sex on the internet?
It was definitely, I mean, it's, yeah, it's in the name. Like they were talking about quote unquote decency. And then through that process of that legislation moving through the system, then we ended up with Section 230, which created, you know, a way for websites to not be liable for what people do on them.
So the porn sites then have to set up ways after this Communications Decency Act is passed. They have to set up ways to verify the ages of users so that minors aren't using their sites. And so they come up with these credit card payment plans and monthly subscription services. So that was pretty novel, right? Even though now we're used to it for everything we do online.
So yeah, they set up, you know, subscriptions. You know, they pioneered things like online credit card transactions, which was, it was a very novel and like kind of scary idea to put that much information on the internet, because who knows where it would go. But I think most people who really wanted to stay online had to move really quickly and say, how can we keep this sustainable and also save?
So how did that change the internet, and how did it change sex?
So some of the webmasters that I talked to who were around for those really early days and were setting up their own studios and things on the internet, they told me that they were very much destabilized and very shook up by the existence of tube sites, which is like Pornhub, Xvideos, and all these other sites where like porn is like quote unquote free. But in the early days of the tube sites, it was basically stolen porn. Like you could upload whatever you wanted to these sites, including like normal full length movies, which is kind of funny. It wasn't always just porn. So not only did you have people stealing from like the membership sites that worked really hard to make the content good, and then you also had just people like losing that idea that it's something that you should pay for or that you can pay for.
But I wonder if it also created unhealthy expectations too. If you're seeing sex, you see it as kind of dehumanizing, or you see it as violent, or you see it in this, in these ways that are popular in porn, if that changes what you want and what you think is right and good.
Yeah, I think it was definitely a catch-22, because not only do you have this huge access to lots of different things now, no one's really like talking about it like in a really a deep and like normalized way. Things like consent and safe words and talking about like, you know, should we talk about what we're into before we have sex and not like after the fact when we didn't like it. You know, talking about what you see online as being like a fantasy and not reality. And then, like you said, people struggled with the ability to access all this stuff all the time. These sites are designed, and every social media site is designed this way, and then porn sites took the cue too, to keep you on the site. It's not like, oh, now you're done, enjoy your day. It's always like, what's the next thing? What's the next notification? What's the next video you're going to see? Maybe it's better than the one you just saw. So I think that's a lot of really, really harmful kind of attitude toward design and toward creating the internet as we know it, is keeping people on it. You know, a lot of the most amazing things about the internet are connecting with people and then getting off the internet and meeting them in real life, or kind of exploring your interests and then bringing them back to that community. So that doesn't even like begin to scratch the surface, like the ways that people are thinking about how to solve these problems, because we can't like solve these problems with more technology. We have to solve them through openness and talking to each other, and also, you know, thinking about the way society works.
Well, speaking of the future, looks like there'll be more AI, there'll be more VR. How will that, do you think, shape the way we think and have sex?
Yeah, I mean, with the AI stuff, I think AI, I think, is, you know, it's moving faster than we can even kind of grasp or think about the ways that it will affect us, or that it even is affecting us now. You know, we're interacting with AI every day already. And then you see things like the AI art that's going around right now that everybody's using. And, you know, a lot of that is drawing on porn databases and
But like, do you see the future? Could it be like that movie Her, where people are really having relationships with AIs?
I mean, people are doing that now, which is the funny thing. there are kind of small communities that there are people who create kind of, I guess you would say, parasocial relationships with AI chat systems. So they're using like apps to talk to someone, and that someone is a AI. And because it's an AI, it's feeding them back exactly what they want to hear. Or it's, you know, sexting with them. And I try to keep an open mind about it. And, you know, if that's preventing someone from feeling lonely, or, you know, that's kind of the way that they work through some stuff in their life, that's, I think that's harmless and good. But I think what AI is missing is a lot of the stuff that makes us human in like a real life situation. So, you know, you're missing a lot of like the facial cues and, even like things like scent or, you know, small movements of your body, body language, I think make up a lot of the connection that we have with each other. And I wonder if that's what AI will never quite get right. And maybe I'll listen to this in 30 years and I'll be like, wow, we really got it right. And I'm sitting here with my, like, I don't know, AI partner.
Yeah, your ChatGPT best friend.
Exactly. Yeah, but who, you know, that's the thing about this stuff. It's like, who really knows?
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you. This was really great.
That's Samantha Cole, senior editor for Vice's science and technology outlet Motherboard, and her new book is called How Sex Changed the Internet and the Internet Changed Sex. Speaking of the internet, TikTok rules it. Coming up, we'll have an appreciation with design critic Carolina Miranda. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand with an appreciation of TikTok, or at least an attempt to understand how it has absolutely transformed our culture. One of our regulars is here now, Carolina Miranda. She's art and design columnist for the LA Times, and she recently wrote a piece called How TikTok's Addictive Anti-Aesthetic Has Already Conquered Culture. Hi.
Hello.
So we should all give up. Our overlords are here, and we should submit.
We have the algorithm is in charge, and we just need to give into it. It's in our brain. It's running everything.
It is running the world. Well, 3 billion downloads. I get it. What is it about TikTok that makes it so, I don't know, of the moment, so sticky, so addictive, so irresistible to so many people?
TikTok's algorithms have found a way of figuring out what it is you like to watch and delivering more of that content to you. So for someone like me, who has a very odd sense of humor, is into the weird and the bizarre, the app just has this ability to surface more things like that. And as a result, you end up sort of in these corners of the internet that just aren't served by the larger popular culture. And I think that in part is what makes it so absorbing. And I think the other thing is its informality. You know, if Instagram has this certain gloss to it, you know, the beautiful vacation photos, the lovely cappuccino, the fashion, whereas this is, you know, it's people in their car talking, they're in their kitchen, they're wearing their sleeping bonnets. Like, there's something about it that feels very real, even if it's an algorithm.
Yeah, it feels really real. And it's the anti-aesthetic quality of it. How did that come to be? Because it feels sui generis that nobody set out for this to be the aesthetic, but it just kind of became the aesthetic.
Before TikTok was TikTok, when it launched in 2016, it was a lip syncing app called Musical.ly. And it was that app that ended up becoming TikTok. And I think, you know, the leaders of the company really found this kind of performance driven quality in Musical.ly. Like, kids were going on, they were putting on their favorite music, they were performing to it. And I think It's TikTok has its roots in that, in the everyday person going on camera and putting on these wild performances.
Yeah. So, and you write that it is the performance that drives TikTok, that it's not just a picture. And you cite the Kardashians as an example, like, they'll post a picture and it doesn't really work on TikTok.
Yeah, well, they'll post video, but the videos sometimes feel a little dead because they're posing, and TikTok does not play to posing. It is a platform that I think prizes movement, it prizes performance, it prizes wit. You know, some of the most viral TikToks are simply where somebody's reacting in a very funny way or doing a funny dance move.
Right. And that repetition thing is also fascinating, how that has become such an essential part of TikTok. Like, there's an original TikTok video that goes viral, and then there are all of the imitators and the satirists and everyone else who's doing a bit on that particular video, which is fascinating. And I'm sure there are a million English major theses in there. But what do you think that says about our culture?
I mean, I think part of it is, you know, it's this way of being involved in this conversation. It also creates this somewhat low bar for entry. Like, if you were going to say start a YouTube channel, that might feel like a very overwhelming thing. Like, what would I talk about? What would I do? Whereas on TikTok, you can take something that already exists, put your own spin on it, and still have some measure of virality to it. It makes it less daunting as a user to do that than to, say, come up with something from scratch. And then what ends up happening too is that something will go viral, and then you'll just see these very funny riffs on that idea echo throughout the platform. And part of what one of the functions that TikTok has is it has the duet function, which allows you to place your video next to another person's video. And I think that's part of, honestly, what makes the app very unique, is this ability to not just put a like or a comment or a retweet, but to do this duet in which you can live react to something as it happens.
So it's really a conversation between you watching the person who's watching the other video and adapting it to their own. And then maybe you'll do one, a duet of the duet.
And it could be endless. You know, there is this phenomenon on TikTok known as the duet train. You know, when sea shanties became popular on TikTok in 2021, somebody posted a video of a sea shanty, then somebody posted a duet adding their vocals over that sea shanty, then a third person maybe added some instrumentation, then a fourth person came along and added drums. And that makes it a really remarkable way to react to something that goes beyond, you know, just that, like, Facebook like.
So, right. So this is a super popular part of TikTok. Also, but the original content, I mean, I'm always amazed at how creative people are in their own bedrooms or what have you, with very low production value. And you point to one that you really like, a woman named Kendria Bland. She has 1.3 million followers. Tell us about her and what you like about her.
She is a comedian from Mississippi, and she does these very funny, she has a series of different posts. One consists of this running skits, kind of Saturday Night Live style skits that she does about this pack of roaches that live behind a refrigerator. And she plays all the different roaches, differentiating the different roaches with different wigs. Super low production values, and is able to do this partly because of TikTok's incredible editing abilities within the app. You know, you can make these mini movies and they're very lo-fi, but if you're a clever content creator, you can deploy those in absolutely incredible ways.
You end your piece saying TikTok is real life. And I went, oh my God, what?
We are all just units in the matrix at this point.
I have to say, I've avoided TikTok because I know that once I get into it, I'll be sucked into it. And then I feel like my real life will be over. But are you saying just you can't avoid it? Jump in?
I'm not saying jump in. The app does harvest an incredible amount of data off of your usage. It has been banned from government apps as a result in the United States. But I do think that even if you're not in TikTok, you have seen echoes of it elsewhere in culture. You know, like recently Google redesigned its search pages based on the ways on which, you know, teenagers and tweeners use TikTok. Even if you're not on TikTok and you have no plans to get on TikTok, there are aspects of its aesthetic that have already seeped into the wider culture.
Amazing. And at the same time, people are afraid, you know, government officials are afraid, as you alluded to, that information, sensitive information, could be compromised because this is a Chinese-owned company. And they could be spying on you, us, what have you. And there seems to be a low level of panic among government officials about TikTok. Maybe not so low level.
No, it's not low level. In fact, in the last federal spending bill, there was language in there that banned TikTok from all government devices. So that's now federal law. And because it lies to some degree beyond the grasp of U.S. regulators, you know, a lot of concern.
Yeah. So how much time do you spend on it per day? Be honest.
Some nights I just find myself inhaled because there is a lot of clever, funny stuff. You know, the Kevin McCarthy Speaker of the House votes was the subject of much grist on TikTok.
Well, you know, I see a lot of that on Instagram, I guess, from people like you who post TikToks on Instagram. So I don't have to be there. So
exactly. You don't even need to be on TikTok to experience it.
Right. To get your Kevin McCarthy memes. So yay. Exactly. All right. Carolina Miranda, art and design columnist for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Hey, you can check us out on Instagram and on Twitter, or me at least, at The Mad Brand. That is the handle. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.